As Lorelei comes forward to light the chalice, please read the words together with me that should be projected on the screen in a moment. We gather this hour as people of faith, with joys and sorrows, gifts and needs. We light this beacon of hope, sign of our quest for truth and meaning, in celebration of the life we share together.
Before I invite the Artworks folks to depart, I would like to show you a slide. I hope it can be projected. This is a map, but it may be a map that is not familiar to some of us. You will see that South America is there, and that Africa, the continent of Africa, is right here. This is a map that shows a perspective of the world different from what many of us grew up with, what many of us think about. A map is an interpretation of the world. It's not reality. It's an interpretation of our understanding of reality. And this map was created in 1979. It's called the Universal Corrective Map of the World. And it was not created by a radical geographer, revolutionary cartographer. It's created by a 15-year-old. And his name was Stuart MacArthur. And Stuart was from Australia, which is up here. And Stuart was a high school exchange student in the Northern Hemisphere in Japan, which is down here. And he grew tired of being teased at being from the bottom of the world, being teased about being from down under. He didn't feel that Australia was under anything. And so he created this map to show his perspective. And it's not the first map to show a different perspective with the Southern Hemisphere at the top. It's not the first one in the world. Centuries ago, there were others. But this one became very popular, and it has sold 350,000 copies since 1979. And I think about those of us who feel a need to change the world, and sometimes that takes changing perspective and inviting others to change perspectives. So I just wanted to show you that today.
We only moved twice during my childhood. The first move was from Concord, California, to a rental house in Sacramento just for a year. And we subsequently moved to nearby Arden Park, where my parents continued to live until my dad's retirement. Growing up, I only went to school with white kids. My family was an upwardly mobile, white, middle-class family who taught me that all people were the same, no matter the color of their skin. At 16, I started volunteering at the Eaglet Theater as a backstage technician. I met Willie, who was the senior class president from another school. He invited me to his senior prom, and when I excitedly told my parents, they told me I couldn't go because he was black. I was astonished. Their reasoning? They couldn't risk having racially mixed grandchildren. Oh my God, it was a dance. Their prejudice went against everything they had taught me. They calmed me, informed me I could have as many black girlfriends as I liked, but I couldn't date black boys. Such hypocrisy. It fueled my teenage anger and despise. The most ironic and tragic part of the story was Willie drowned in the river a few months later, and I never attended a school dance. Graduating high school in 1969 with only marginal academic grades, I was still expected to go to college. Unlike my scholarly sister, who went directly to Cal in Berkeley, my parents said I should go to American River Junior College, and I rejected that school as being too white, and I moved out. I subsequently chose Sacramento City College due to its diversity. My education and awareness of social issues was nurtured by those early college years. I got involved in gay liberation, women's liberation, and explored emerging ideas of class and privilege. I finally graduated from college 10 years after high school with a Bachelor of Science degree and a minor's degree in women's studies. I intellectually understood that we carry internalized homophobia and racism. And I joined my other white sisters by decrying the lack of diversity in our coffee shops, women's support groups, and lesbian social events. I was concerned by my overly white circle of friends, but didn't know what to do. I started going to Unitarian Universalist Community Church in 1991. Finding a group that included kind, caring, and compassionate men was like a balm for my cultivated early anger toward the white patriarchy. Last year, I signed up for the UUA Beloved Conversations on Race Reconciliation through UUSS. My eyes were opened to historical, social, emotional, and spiritual practices based on race that have wounded all of us. My fears that make America great again really means make America white again is truer than I knew. I learned how our country engaged in systematic racism, which lifted up white people to follow the American dream, but often shut out our kindred people of color. White privilege gave my parents unique opportunities they passed on to me. Where I grew up and where I went to school was directly related to white privilege. Millions of soldiers came home after World War II and started families. My dad left the Army in 1948. My then poor working class parents were able to buy their first home in Concord, California in 1951 due to the GI Bill. The GI Bill made low interest home loans with no down payment readily available to white soldiers, but much less to black soldiers. Why? Although the loans were guaranteed by the VA, they were funded by local banks who often refused to grant loans to soldiers who were not white. After the Great Depression, the Federal Housing Authority subsidized builders to mass produce urban subdivisions. Returning soldiers needed housing, and these new urban areas were earmarked for white people. Concerned that integrated housing would decrease the property values of whites, areas were redlined with whites-only language. Quote, no person other than one of the Caucasian race shall be permitted to occupy any portion of any in said lot or plat or any building thereon, except a domestic servant actually employed by a Caucasian occupant of said lot or building. Although outlawed by the Fair Housing Act of 1968, this language continues to exist on deeds here in California and presumably all the other states. My growing up in white-only neighborhoods and attending all-white schools did not just happen. It was orchestrated. Our government programs and institutions involving the GI Bill and the Federal Housing Authority created segregation and upward mobility of white families while denying similar opportunities to black families. Outrageous. I am so grateful to the Unitarian Universalist denomination, which challenges me to examine racism in this country and the role I play. It challenges me to examine my roots and culture with new awareness. My own personal ignorance and racism can give way to action and reconciliation. This work is just a beginning.
Let's rise in body or spirit and sing together Amazing Grace, number 205.
A little over a year ago, in the locker room at the gym, my buddy whispered, "Psst, hey Roger, I heard a story about your religious denomination on NPR. Something about white supremacists." He was confused. He didn't know if we'd been attacked, infiltrated, or what. "No," I said, "just us, just our culture." I didn't go into the story for him, but here's a summary for you. In the spring of 2017, a major hiring decision was announced by our UUA headquarters, and it brought a lot of criticism and controversy. UU ministers, religious educators, and lay leaders of color complained. They pointed out that, with rare exceptions, the Unitarian Universalist Association has always hired white executives and white managers. The elected UUA president at the time was defensive in handling that criticism, making matters worse. As a result, he resigned as president only 3 months before the end of his term. Soon, this was followed by resignations of the vice president and of the department manager who had made the hiring decision. To serve in the vacant presidential role until the election in June, the UUA board appointed an interim co-presidency of three respected UU leaders, all people of color. To the many hurting staff members left behind at the Unitarian Universalist Association, these three leaders provided a listening pastoral presence. They also recommended several steps for study, reflection, and institutional change. The UUA board created a volunteer commission of leaders to learn, review, and recommend institutional changes at the UUA level. Since her election as the new UUA president a year ago, the Reverend Susan Frederick Gray has provided clear, steady, and brave leadership toward those changes. She says that as Unitarian Universalists, all of us have been charged not only to meet the world's need for love and justice, but also to examine the entrenched assumptions, habits, and structures by which our institutions operate. We must bring more love and justice to our own house. The UUA is a historically white institution and tradition. Hence, our cultural habits and attitudes have tended to neglect, ignore, or disregard the perspectives of people of color and others on the margins of American society. The culture in which our congregations were established was a culture of white supremacy. Now, how you react to this description may depend on the experiences you've had in your life and whether you identify as white or not. Since that UUA crisis of a year and a half ago, many Unitarian Universalist leaders of color have said, yes, that's what it feels like, white supremacy culture. That's what many of us have been trying to tell you. I must confess, I had heard them over the years, but I didn't always listen. I didn't get it. My perspective was that of a white person and a white male. This has been the favored and centered perspective of the UUA and the dominant American culture in which our congregations exist. I didn't see whose experiences were kept out of the center of consideration, didn't realize whose critiques, needs, and longings were discounted. It is humbling to realize that now. Black Lives of Unitarian Universalism is a fairly new group. It's an organizing collective of UU lay leaders, religious educators, and ministers of color. Known as BLUU, or BLUE for short, it has provided materials for white supremacy teach-ins at UU congregations. It starts out by explaining that complicated term. Yes, white supremacy can conjure up images of armed, angry mobs and men in white hoods. In this case, however, white supremacy culture means a set of institutional assumptions and practices. Often operating unconsciously, these practices tend to benefit white people and exclude people of color. The presence of hateful white supremacists is not necessary to uphold and perpetuate a culture of supremacy. In this difficult political moment, Blue says, this is a key distinction for us to make, for us as a faith community to remember as we work toward a more just society. The Reverend William Barber II, an African-American progressive Christian, has lamented this nation's inability to see racism as systemic. He said, America has never wanted to talk about race except with regard to interpersonal relationships. Furthermore, so much discussion of racism has been defined by ideas of individual bigotry and prejudice and ugly images of hatred. Recoiling from such images can make well-meaning white folks worry about being racist or being thought of as such. Perhaps defensively, we have the urge to say, I'm not racist. Or preemptively, we have the urge to confess, yes, I'm a racist. Yet systemic racism is bigger than any one of us. Our society and economy have been racialized from the first contacts between European conquerors and natives, and between colonizers and enslaved Africans. We are all caught up, all of us caught up, in systemic racism. Yet it falls most directly on people of color, falls most painfully on black and brown bodies. Government policies have led to mass incarceration of tens of millions of Americans, with a disproportionate percentage of them people of color. Inadequate public schooling and a punitive culture in schools generate a school-to-prison pipeline, and many of the kids pushed through it are black and brown. In overall numbers, to be sure, there are more poor white people in this country than poor people of color. Yet poverty rates and infant mortality rates and other important indicators are several times higher for African Americans than for European Americans. In his novels, essays, and interviews, the late James Baldwin pointed out the systemic degradation and suppression of African Americans. To white America, he said, "If I love you, I have to make you conscious of the things that you don't see." 2 months ago, at this year's General Assembly of the UUA, Brittany Packnett gave the annual Ware Lecture. This 33-year-old woman of color is a writer, educator, and activist. She challenged us with eloquence rivaling that of Baldwin and with love. Packnett said, "Supremacy is so normative, so ingrained in our culture, that you may not be aware of it." Here is an example of how a culture of white supremacy in our Unitarian heritage worked for the benefit of our congregation in Sacramento. In a sermon last summer, Reverend Lucy recounted stories of ministers of color in the early 1900s who had been inspired by Unitarianism. They wanted to be Unitarian ministers in New York City, in the Caribbean, and elsewhere. In Boston, the white leaders of the American Unitarian Association discouraged them. No church would be likely to hire them, they were advised. People of color would be not interested in our faith, they were told. Yet these black men persisted. They started their own churches, reaching out to communities of color and promoting our free and open faith. The Unitarian headquarters in Boston provided only a little bit of funding to start them out. But after a while, it called those efforts a failure and cut off support. Yet at the very same time, the denomination was giving subsidies to white congregations, including this one. For 6 decades, we got money from Boston, money for outreach in Sacramento, money to get ministers, money to keep us going in the hard times. It was not until the 1950s that our congregation ceased relying on subsidies from its denomination. In her lecture to us, Brittany Packnett said, "You do not have to be a white supremacist to benefit from white supremacy culture, any more than you have to be a misogynist to benefit from patriarchy." She charged us, especially those of us who are white, to become aware of the workings of supremacy. She urged us to stretch ourselves and ally ourselves with people who are vulnerable, to see and to hear people who experience the exclusion of this culture. We can't avoid living in supremacy culture, but we can practice becoming aware of how it works. In our culture, whiteness is seen as neutral, as the norm, even if it's not seen. For example, as white professor of English Robert Dale Parker writes, whiteness has been present in the works of white writers, even if not acknowledged. He writes, wherever race may seem absent, perhaps in novels by Jane Austen and Henry James, in poems by Alexander Pope and Emily Dickinson, in films by Alfred Hitchcock, and stories by Edgar Allan Poe, whiteness is nevertheless always there. We may not recognize race when race comes masked in the false neutrality of invisible whiteness. But it's there and it's central. In a culture where whiteness is the norm, people of color may see it and feel its effects, probably do. When the centrality of whiteness is pointed out to many white folks, we sometimes react with defensiveness. In June of 1993, our denomination's General Assembly took place in Charlotte, North Carolina. The big social event of our yearly gathering at our GA is a dance on Saturday night. In 1993, the GA Planning Committee gave it a theme, the Thomas Jefferson Ball, to mark the 250th anniversary of the birth of that famous Unitarian president and champion of religious liberty. Advance publicity for the ball said, dress in period costumes, ball gowns and top hats and things like that. With white allies protesting at their side, black Unitarian Universalists raised the question, do you want us to dress in rags as our period costumes? Shall we wear chains? I don't recall how the dance ended up, but I do recall the conversations those complaints generated. For many UUs of color, this time of pain surely raised the question, will our faith movement ever feel spiritually safe for us? For some white Unitarian Universalists, this time of pain was a learning experience, learning how whiteness is at the center of our assumptions and how our habits can keep the experience of UUs of color out of the center of consideration. To be sure, those event organizers were not violent white nationalists, nor were the Unitarian leaders who gave subsidies to white middle-class congregations for decades while discouraging black Unitarians from the ministry. Yet we can be well-meaning and still cause harm. This is how supremacy culture works. Stories like this make me ask, what are we missing now? Can we analyze the habits and attitudes in the systems in which we live, work, play, and worship? Those on the receiving end of hurt probably see the systems working all too well. For those of us who don't see it, we can practice curiosity. We can listen. We can question the centrality of the lens through which we have been interpreting the world. This is hard and it can be embarrassing, and it calls for humility. I'm embarrassed to say this, but I have had ministerial friends of color for 2 decades, but only recently heard of the pushback that some of them get when they stray from the norms of the dominant culture of the congregation that they are serving. One successful colleague has told me that one key to their success in our culture was this: I learned how to be white. For me to consider the toll that it takes on my gifted colleagues and my friends to live out their commitment to this faith is more than humbling.
and I admire the resilience of their souls and am in awe of the depth of their calling. I give thanks for their patience and presence. I am grateful for their faith in this faith. To decenter a harmful set of habits and assumptions will not be a quick fix. Changing a culture is work that lasts a lifetime, and it's work that changes shape over time. Yet it is work. In approving our 5-year strategic plan in May, this congregation did commit to deepen our understanding of our role in perpetuating racist inequities and habits and assumptions. And our plan says this is part of living out our commitment to justice, equity, and compassion. If you are moved to be part of this work, or even if you're curious about it, please feel free to contact Reverend Lucy or me or the strategic planning team. But let me be clear about the work. It is not about attracting people of color to our churches so we feel better about our churches. It is not about diversity for its own sake. Diversity is not a bad outcome. And in any case, diversity is growing. Yet the work for us right now is to learn how cultures of social oppression work and to see how some of us benefit unconsciously from those cultures and how others learn to survive in them. This work could last longer than our 5-year plan, longer than a lifetime. Hence, as a faith community, we should be careful to avoid behaviors that reinforce or reflect the culture of supremacy that we want to decenter and move away from. A few of the traits of supremacy culture are perfectionism, defensiveness, and urgency. In an online article, the activist and writer Tema Okun says that for individuals, perfectionism means failing to appreciate your own good work. Too often you let your inner critic focus on mistakes and inadequacies. In organization, perfectionism is a tendency to point out what's wrong, what's not good enough, what somebody didn't do. It sees mistakes as personal failures rather than simply as what they are. Mistakes. So many times I've given sermons about our struggles with perfectionism, and the response of church members has been strong and heartfelt. No wonder perfectionism is a reflection of the dominant culture of this country. No wonder it touches so deeply when we touch on it. So, what are the antidotes to perfectionism, the ways we can heal from perfectionism? Okun recommends the spiritual discipline of patience, the reminder of our basic humanity, and the practice of gratitude and appreciation. Another habit of supremacy culture is defensiveness, responding to new or different ideas without exploring them, and reacting to challenging but respectful feedback with hurt, or reacting with anger or justification or shaming. Defensiveness can keep us from looking at how racism or other forms of oppression could be operating in a system or a culture. I'll admit that I can identify with both defensiveness and perfectionism. Of course I do. I learned them in my dominant culture institutions, starting with the institution known as the family, my family. In the face of conflict or critiques, what are some antidotes to defensiveness? Okun recommends that we approach our challenges by practicing humility and curiosity. Humility and curiosity, and by staying present through feelings of discomfort. Another trait of supremacy culture is a continued sense of urgency, in Okun's words. While justice issues are important, an urgency toward wanting to fix things quickly is pressure toward making our discomfort go away. Continued urgency only makes it harder to take the time to be inclusive, to be reflective, to take the time to encourage and include the participation of others in the decision making. What are antidotes to a continued sense of urgency? They include more patience and more humility. They include keeping a sense of balance and equanimity in spite of the nature of the crisis, and keeping a long-term vision. These antidotes are how we engage in uprooting racism, not as a project, but as a spiritual practice. Instead of perfectionism, a practice of appreciation and gratitude. Instead of defensiveness, a practice of humility and curiosity. Instead of the push of urgency, a practice of patience, equanimity, and keeping a longer and wider view. I'd like to finish by quoting a UU minister of color's words from the UUA book entitled Centering, which includes numerous reflections by UU religious leaders of color. The Reverend Dr. Natalie Fenimore is an African American minister serving a congregation in the New York area. Natalie says this: I'm in love with the Unitarian Universalism that does not yet exist. But I have to hold both the love for that thing and the love for the reality. It does not yet exist. It will probably not exist in my lifetime. But I cannot deny my love for it. Now, please join me again for a few moments in the spiritual practice of silence. And so may it be. Blessed be, and amen.